Next up, we'll talk about Graham Phillips' journey to find the lost tomb of King Arthur, Camelot, in just a moment, and your calls on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. This hour, we'll take your phone calls with our special guest, Graham Phillips. His latest book is called Wisdom Keepers of Stonehenge. And Graham, you've also got a book called The Lost Tomb of King Arthur, which I believe came out when, in 2016?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, a couple of years ago now. Well, 3 years ago.
Was Arthur real or was he mythical?
Well, the King Arthur we seem to know of today, the man who fights dragons, rescues damsels in distress and all that sort of thing, was really a medieval invention. But the character that they base these stories on seems to have really existed around about the year 500 AD. Now, he would have been very different from the sort of character that's portrayed in the modern myths and legends. They're set during the Middle Ages, like the period of Robin Hood, knights in armor, big Gothic castles, whereas the historical Arthur would have lived in the post-Roman period. The Roman Empire had just collapsed. So the actual appearance of Arthur and his warriors would have been more like Roman soldiers, and they wouldn't have had huge Gothic castles, but wooden stockades and embankments of earth surrounding settlements. Now, this figure is known to have existed through a few documents and manuscripts that have survived from a period known as the Dark Ages. After the Roman Empire collapsed around the late 400s, for about a 500-year period, most of Europe was in a period of turmoil, anarchy, where it broke up into lots of small kingdoms, all feuding with each other. And from this period, very few manuscripts or written works have survived. But from the few that have, we learn that King Arthur was an historical figure, that he did rule from the most powerful city in Britain, and that he united these various different tribes of the British Isles, or well, of Britain and what's now England and Wales, to fight an invading people from Germany called the Anglo-Saxons. And for a period of about 30 years, he held the invaders at bay, and Britain was very prosperous indeed. So, yes, there was an historical figure behind the legend, and I decided to set out and find out who he was, where he came from, and ultimately where he was buried.
Amazing. Let's take some calls as we continue chatting. Graham, let's go to Palos Verdes, California. Clint's with us. Hey, Clint, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you for taking my call.
Sure thing.
Graham, I have to say, I have no question, but I just wanted to give you props for the breadth and reach of what you, everything you look at, you examine in such great detail and document in such great detail. It's just amazing. I've bought every book, every one of your books. I haven't read all of them, I'm sorry to say. But appeared out at the, you did a talk when you released a Supernatural at the Body Tree in Los Angeles, and I was there, and I asked you a question, and you actually, you thought you knew me from somewhere, but you're an amazing scholar, and you're not afraid of, you know, delving into subjects that most scholars would much rather prefer to avoid.
You don't back down, Graham. I can believe that right now.
Well, that's very, very kind of you to say so. What I try and do, not being attached to any university or academic institution, is I can examine the work of archaeologists, many of whom don't even speak to one another, because archaeology is a subject where you can only really concentrate on some specific era of history and maybe just a particular place. And the same with historians. They can only really concentrate with such a narrow beam that they kind of all have the answers to some of these unsolved historical enigmas between them, but there's nobody there to put it all together. So what I do is I interview these people, I go along on these digs, I read the works of other historians, and then I go back to the original source material, finding out where they got this information from, which is often the writings of, say, the Romans or the Greeks, piece it all together like a giant big jigsaw puzzle, and hope to come up with answers.
Graham, was Merlin for real, or was he mythological too?
Well, strangely, of the characters that are from the Arthurian story, the one that you would think would be the most likely one to have been made up is Merlin the Magician. But there are historical records to show that a man called Merlin did in fact live at the same time as King Arthur. And he's old enough to have perhaps acted as an advisor to the king. Now, the people of Britain at this time had a tradition of characters called druids, who seem to have been the successors of those who once used the stone circles. And they possessed all sorts of... they had, for example, the Romans tell us about the druids, is that they possessed these remarkable memories. They were able to do things like today we would call hypnosis, as well as having cures for various diseases, as I've been talking about. And such people very often were advisors to kings and tribal leaders. And the figure that was, I believe, the historical King Arthur, did have one of these people who was an advisor to him, who went by the name of Merlin. So he may not have been able to do everything that's portrayed in the films, but he certainly existed.
Next up, Kathy's with us in Winnipeg, Canada, International Line. Hi, Kath. Go ahead.
Oh, hello, gentlemen.
Hi there.
How's everybody tonight?
Everybody's great and glad you got through.
Oh, that's good. I got a couple things I wanted to talk about. I was wondering if Graham had heard about Marshenge.
Marshenge.
Marshenge. No.
Tell us a little bit about that, Kath.
Pardon me?
Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, I don't know too much about it. I just found out about it tonight on the internet, so I don't know how reliable it is. But apparently, they've seen the same formation of stones on Mars that replicate Stonehenge down in England.
Okay, and what's your second?
Well, that would be amazing if that turned out to be true. I certainly know that the only replica of Stonehenge that's actually been made, with the stones exactly as they were and to the right size of what they were originally, happens to be in Australia, but I haven't heard of Marshenge.
Okay. And my second question is, and by the way, you've got a nice country, because I did visit Stonehenge. When I visited Stonehenge, I picked up a picture about the warring planet of Mars over Stonehenge at 11 o'clock at night. And what I was going to say was, I asked my friend what relevant the date on that was, and he said that was the start of the Iraq War.
Interesting.
I know that this, the Romans tell us that the people who were using Stonehenge when they arrived around 2,000 years ago in Britain, said that the stone circles were not only used for purposes of determining when to grow and sow certain crops, but also for astrological purposes. In other words, so that they could get a good bearing on where the planets were to make astrological predictions. So that is certainly one of the purposes of the stone circles.
You definitely have to go online, Graham, after the program and take a look at this Marshenge and take a look at it.
Never heard of it.
It's a circle. It looks very eroded, but it clearly looks like a circle. And so one would wonder, maybe it was a small asteroid or meteor impact site that, you know, spit it out into a round circle. I don't know, but it looks weird.
I really will. I'm trying to look it up now as we speak.
Take
online.
It up. Yeah, and then we got
How weird.
You see that?
I've got pictures of it here.
Okay.
It does look like a sort of stone circle. It might just be a coincidence, but it's certainly worth looking into.
Kathy, thanks for that. Let's go to Mike, truck driving in Virginia, east of the Rockies. Michael, go ahead.
Hey, George. Man, I can't believe I got through.
Perfect.
I was calling about when I was a teenager, my mom, you remember the old Time Life books you used to
have? Oh, sure do. You used to have some.
Yeah, and one of the stories in there was about a man that built the Coral Castle in Florida, and I was wondering if your guests had ever looked into that or studied it.
Coral Castle down in Florida was built by a fellow by the name of Edward Leed Scaldon, Graham, and he built these structures all by himself. One would say it's impossible because they're huge, but he did say he knew the secrets of the pyramids and that everything was magnetized, even blocks of stone. But did you ever hear him?
No. I'm answering a lot of no's, aren't I? When did he do this guy?
Oh, back in the 1900s, I think, something like that.
Yeah, the thing about the people have said that certainly the Egyptians were able to work rocks and stone much, much more precisely than the people of Stonehenge. Stonehenge was hacked about with prehistoric instruments. But when you look into some of the stones of ancient Egypt, you're talking about a different level altogether. Some people have said that, oh, well, maybe the Stonehenge building tradition of stone circles in Britain came from Egypt. Well, if it did, the stone circles would be a lot better. They would be perfectly square. But then again, the Egyptians were working with much softer sandstone,
right,
when very often the Britons were working with granite, which is a lot more difficult to quarry.
No Dine, Minnesota. Let's go to Nick, first-time caller. Hey, Nick, go ahead, sir.
Hi, George. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure thing.
Great show tonight. I just wanted to tell Graham that last September, I visited Shropshire in Wales, and I was based in Shrewsbury area. And thanks to Graham's wonderful research that I had been reading about the Arthurian legends, I visited a couple of sites there near Shrewsbury. One was these great Roman ruins of a Roman city outside Roxeter, of Viriconium. And Graham will tell you all about that. And also, the next day I went up to Bass Church, and I hung out there with the locals at the New Inn and asked him about his research there, where there's a possible gravesite of the old Owain the Bear, maybe. And they told me that as of then, I was the first tourist that had come through there that was inquiring about that. They said the year before they had a lot of visitors, but they said as of last September it had calmed down, and they said that the landowner, they claimed the landowner that where the site is was still apprehensive about, you know, letting anyone in there. And I wanted to ask Graham if they've been had any luck doing any research on that site.
All right, Graham, have you?
Well, firstly, you mentioned Viriconium. That was an old Roman ruin, smack bang in the centre of England, where it was the principal city in all of Britain at the time Arthur is said to have lived. So in my theory, that would be where the most important king in Britain lived at the time, and according to the few historical sources that remain, that was King Arthur. So by visiting the Roman ruin of Viriconium, just outside the village of Roxeter in central England, you may be visiting the ruins of the historical Camelot. And the man who is there, you mentioned a man, Owain van Gwyn, he's recorded as having, he's the man who seems to have been the historical Arthur, because he had a battle name, a title, which was Ursus in Latin, which means the bear. And in Old Brythonic, the language spoken in Britain at the time, the word for a bear is Arth, and Arthur literally means the bear. So one of the reasons why people hadn't found Arthur before I started to do the research was because they were looking for a man whose name was Arthur, where in fact it was his title. Now, That man, we know from various records, is buried at a place called, in the old manuscripts, it's called the Churches of Bassa. And there is a place still called Bass Church, just north of where Viriconium is. And there's a hillock there where Arthur, where this man, Owen Thangwyn, the bear, Arthur, was laid to rest. And I got involved, all sorts of archaeologists, and they did ground scanning radar over that area and found a grave, and found that there was evidence of a grave underneath the ground at exactly the place I said that this man was buried. This is Arthur's burial site. Unfortunately, because it's a protected monument, the authorities, called English Heritage, wouldn't allow a dig to take place. So what happened is, my book came out a couple of years ago, people started traipsing all over the countryside, probably trying to dig this grave up, and the local farmer basically said, I'm having nobody else coming on my land, leaving fences at gates open so that cows can get out and so forth. And to some degree, that's good, because it means that people can't get in there to start damaging the grave. So that explains all that.
It's amazing. And did King Arthur ever, with the legend, pull a saw, Excalibur, his sword, out of a rock?
There's a site on, I've got a thing called the King Arthur Trail, but if you go on my website on grahamphillips.net, there's a thing there saying King Arthur Trail. You click on it, you can see all the sites on a little map that are around where I believed Arthur had his Camelot at Viriconium, and you can see arrows pointing to, with little videos that I've got that took, you know, describe all of these places. The place that Arthur is supposed to have drawn the sword from the stone is a few miles south of Viriconium, and it is a stone circle of all places. And there was a stone in this stone circle in the middle of it, which local legend for years had said is where Arthur pulled the stone, pulled the sword from the stone. And it's got a little hole in it that people say that's where the sword stood. What's interesting is that back at the time Arthur is said to have lived, 1,500 years ago, if there was a some sort of dispute about who would be ruler of a kingdom, and if there was two contendants, mm-hmm. what they would do is to fight a duel, not necessarily unto the death. They would fight a duel, and the winner would pull a sword from a stone placed in one of these stone circles, and the sword became their symbolic representation of their kingship, in the same way as a crown would be today.
It must have been fascinating for you to investigate all these old historical legends and stories.
Well, yeah, I mean, with the King Arthur one then led on to something else, which was the search for the Holy Grail, which ended up me finding there was a family that lived in Shropshire, very near to where the Viriconium is, in a castle, which is described in some of these old manuscripts about where the Grail was supposed to be kept.
And the Grail was the chalice that Jesus drank from, right?
This is, no, yes and no. There is, in the early stories, there are two Holy Grails. One, a chalice that Jesus drank from, which one disciple used to collect his blood. Another, a small scent jar used by his follower Mary Magdalene to collect a few drops of his blood during the crucifixion.
Hold on, Graham. Let's come right back with our final segment. We'll finish up on that discussion and take final calls. And welcome back to Coast on our next program. We talk a little bit about psychedelics and then also your soul on Coast to Coast AM. And, of course, we're going to come back in a moment with final calls with Graham Phillips. And welcome back. Our final segment here with Graham Phillips. Graham, we were talking about the Holy Grail, and there seems to be a discussion between the chalice and the Grail. What was that?
Well, the story we tend to know about the Grail today is that it was the cup used by Jesus at the Last Supper that his disciple, one of his followers, Joseph of Arimathea, used to collect a few drops of his blood while he was being crucified, while Jesus was on the cross. And that imbued this chalice, this cup, with miraculous healing properties. And it was taken by Joseph out of Palestine, ended up in Britain, because that at the time was outside the Roman Empire, and the Christians were being persecuted, and he hid it somewhere in Britain, and many years later, King Arthur and his knights went searching for this cup to cure the King Arthur when he became grievously ill. But that wasn't the original Grail story. The original stories that are written about in ancient manuscripts talk about the cup being used to collect Christ's blood as being something that belonged to his follower, Mary Magdalene. Now, the Bible tells us that she went to the tomb of Jesus and was the first one to see him risen. And she went there with a small scent jar that contained an oil called spikenard, which was used, according to Jewish tradition, to anoint the body of the dead. She went to the tomb to do this, finding that Jesus had risen, and she used this cup to collect a few drops of the blood that came from the wounds in his hand. That's the Bible story. Now, the tradition then is that this cup was imbued with healing powers, and exactly the same as the Grail story of Joseph of Arimathea, Mary Magdalene eventually had the cup brought to Britain. It was hidden and later sought by King Arthur and his knights. Now, the first of the Grail stories that was written about King Arthur's knights, written about 1190, tells us that the cup was kept in a chapel in a place called the White Castle in the White Land. Now, near the place where I believe Arthur is buried, there is indeed a place known as the White Town. And this is, again, where the early stories tell us that the Grail Castle is situated. It's now called Whittington, which means, in Old English, White Town, Whittington. And there is a castle there known as the White Castle, because it was built from light-colored sandstone. And the family that lived there at the time the first Arthurian stories were written actually claimed to have possessed this little scent jar that belonged to Mary Magdalene. And many years later, one of their descendants in the mid-1800s had no children to hand it on to, hid this cup, left an elaborate series of clues to where it was, including a stained glass window in a nearby church at a place called Hodnet. And I went there, I analyzed the clues that were left in this stained glass window, and eventually discovered that somebody in the 1920s had already found this cup. And I thought, I've been beaten to it. But by tracing their descendant, who was a lady who lived in a town in central England called Rugby, I went there, I spoke to her, and she said, yeah, we've still got it, I think, up in the attic. And they went up there, and wrapped up in old newspaper was this small stone chalice. I took it to the British Museum, and they analyzed it as being made from a stone that came from the area of Jerusalem.
Wow.
And that it was 2,000 years old, and it was a scent jar. In other words, it came from the right place and the right time to have belonged to Mary Magdalene, and could well have collected the blood of Jesus. And if anybody wants to see a picture of it, go on my website, have a look at the book I wrote about it called The Chalice of Magdalene, click on that, and there's a whole description of exactly how I found it, plus photographs of the cup itself.
Let's go to final calls. Joe in the Bronx, welcome to the program. Joseph, hey. Go ahead.
Hi, George. How are you?
Okay.
Graham?
Hello.
Hi, how are you? I wanted to ask you, now there are so many relics that survived from the Middle Ages and earlier. What is the process, or how are they confirmed to be the genuine articles?
Well, if it's found in what they call in situ, in the ground, archaeologists can determine that the ground has been undisturbed for so many years, and by analyzing the soil, they can actually date the soil. You can date an object that's made from something that was once organic, i.e. bone, wood, by radiocarbon dating, but you can't necessarily date stone. So in the case of this Grail cup, the way that the British Museum dated it is by saying, okay, let's have a look at the style of it. And they showed me, when I went there, many other cups that were of the Roman period that were used to contain scent. They once had a little lid for them, which this no longer had, and said it's of the style. But they are able to tell that there is amount of crystalline buildup on the outside of a stone object over the years. And unless it's been polished or interfered with in some way, they can get a rough estimation of the period of time. So that's basically how they do it.
Okay, Joe, thank you. Good luck. Let's go next to Renee in St. John's, Michigan. Hi, Renee. Go ahead.
Hi, how are you guys tonight?
We're fine, thanks.
I was telling Tom, my grandpa found an old book, which was a biography of Merlin, and in that book at the front of it, when they're starting to tell the tale, it said that Merlin and King Arthur were first cousins. Is there any evidence of that, really?
All right. Graham, were they cousins, Merlin and King Arthur?
Well, remember I said that Arthur has got, his name actually means the bear. It was a title he used rather than his real name. In the same way as, let's say, Genghis Khan. We all know him as Genghis Khan. That name actually means universal ruler.
Yes.
His title. Exactly. His real name was Temujin. Now, the name Merlin is also a title. It means the eagle. There's still actually a small bird of prey today called a Merlin. And the real name of the person whose name was Merlin, whose title was the eagle, was Ambrosius Aurelius. And he is a cousin of the man who I believe was Arthur, Owen Llanguin, albeit second or third cousins. So the answer to that is yes.
Simple as that. Ed's in Beaumont, Texas. Hey, Eddie, go ahead.
Hey, how you doing, George?
Okay, Ed, thanks for calling.
Thank you. I'd like to ask you, guess something. I've been to every national forest there is in the United States. And every one you go to, there's always a big circle of rocks. And I'm just curious if that could have anything to do with Stonehenge or maybe luck or something like that.
Yeah, are there any Stonehenge structures, Graham, in North America?
Unfortunately, not of the same type as the stone circles you find in Britain. There are arrangements of stones in circles, but they're not put in such a way that they necessarily are big enough to align. You know, if you stand in the center of a stone circle and you want to see a star rising over the horizon, the stones need to be fairly high, and these are smaller, so they may have been made for other purposes. But what I do find is fascinating is that we don't know where the stone circle tradition started from. When it began in the Orkney Islands in the north of Scotland, it was fully intact. They built stone circles just like they were going to do for the next few thousand years. The graves still show that they had these cures that I was talking about, fully developed. I mean, somebody had to have spent years developing this system. I mean, you don't just get to find out the curative properties of plants by just going around and eating everything you find, and if you don't die, that's going to work. I mean, that it wiped out the whole population. So it had to have come from somewhere before it arrived in Britain. And there's nowhere in Europe that seems to have anything like it. And some people have suggested because the sea levels were lower at that time and the temperatures were warmer, that they could have somehow come across from North America. It would have been possible to island hop to Greenland and to Iceland and then to Britain with fairly simple craft. And people have actually reconstructed the craft they had at the time, and they've been able to do it. And so it's possible that the idea of circle builders in Britain did come from the United States. But as yet, this lost civilization, perhaps, in the United States has yet to be found.
What is your next expedition, Graham? What's up?
Well, there's a couple of things. I'm going back to investigating the supernatural, and I'm writing a book all about a strange mystical society that existed in the Victorian period that seems to have collected artifacts that they believed were held mystical powers. And one of these items is Pandora's box. So my next quest is to search for Pandora's box, the mythical item that, according to the Greeks, when opened, released all the evils upon the
world. I was going
to
say, be very careful if you stumble across that. How about the Ark of the Covenant? You ever go looking for that?
Yeah, I've got a book about that called The Templars and the Ark of the Covenant. I went searching for this, followed a series of clues that the Knights Templars who claimed to have found it left, and eventually found the ruins of an old chapel in the English countryside where this ark was supposed to have been. But unfortunately, the whole place was torn down to make way for a road in the 1950s. And I discovered that the person who was in charge of the workmen, who was basically just a poor layer of roads, whatever you call such a person, a builder, suddenly became extraordinarily rich after digging up this old church ruins. And he started a strange kind of Masonic society based around the worship, if you like, or veneration of the Ark of the Covenant. So I'm still in the process of trying to find out what happened to him and his claim that he may have possessed the Ark of the Covenant.
That's an amazing story. I mean, just the biblical discussions of the Ark are fantastic, aren't they?
Well, it's said to have been a gold chest with two angels carved on the top of it that the ancient Israelites made. And it seems to have been, it contained the stones of the Ten Commandments. Now, what is fascinating is it's supposed to be like a radio for talking to God, as it's described in Indiana Jones and the Raiders of the Lost Ark. People who stood near it seem to have got messages from God. It's also said to, in the Bible, to have been used like a sort of high-powered laser light shot from it and destroyed the enemies of the Israelites. But it contained the commandments, the Ten Commandment tablets. What we did manage to find in the ruins of this old church, where they'd been literally scattered around the area, was a broken stone tablet that when examined by the British Museum, they came to the conclusion that this was a 3,000-plus-year-old tablet inscribed with something called proto-Sinaitic script, which is an early form of Hebrew that hasn't yet been translated. And the type of stone that it's made from comes from what is thought to have been Mount Sinai, where the Ten Commandment tablets were obtained and where the Ark was made.
Great mysteries. Let's go to Joan in Anchorage, Alaska. Hello, Joan. You go ahead.
Hello, George and Graham.
Yep.
Hello.
I'm curious if you're familiar with Cahokia Woodhenge, right across the river from St. Louis.
Oh, I am very much so. I've been there.
Yep. It's close to the ground zero for the 2017 eclipse that NASA observed at kind of the central point.
I was there.
Awesome.
I was there. Cahokia Mounds. It's a great mound. Could be a burial ground, could be something else, but they're great structures too, Graham.
Yeah, and we have these burial mounds in Britain. They were, some of them are huge. The largest one in the country is right near Avebury Stone Circle that I've been talking about. It's 300 and something feet high and covers 6 acres, I think, or more. It's huge.
It sure is. Almost out of time, Graham. We've got the a minute to go. Let's get some information out about how people can track your work.
Okay. Well, website, grahamphillips.net. I couldn't get .com, so it's .net.
That works.
Go on that front page, and it's got links to everything and everywhere and whatever it is I do. And if you look for me on Google, just type in Graham Phillips author, and that will differentiate me from Graham Phillips, the actor, or another Graham Phillips, the journalist.
And
Graham Phillips, author, look at my YouTube channel. It's got all the videos of all these places I've been talking about.
And what's your target date for this paranormal book you're working on?
I'm going to hope to get it finished by the end of the year.
All right.
And when it comes out, it's pretty much up to my publishers in the traditions.
You
get on to them. Make sure they bring it out quickly, I say.
We'll count on getting you back when you get that out there, okay?
Thank you.
Super. Graham Phillips, this book is called Wisdom Keepers of Stonehenge. We've got a great series of programs for you for the entire week. Don't forget, we are live on Independence Night, July 4th, and Friday, too. For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean LaDesour, Stephanie Smith, Chris Burrows, Tim Banal, and George Knapp, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.